Hi there. You are tuning in to the 52nd episode of the Audible Weed Walk. This is Nina welcoming you. So, last week, I tried to respond to a common question that if we nurture or grow wild plants, will they still be called wild? In doing so, I had categorized the talk about what we refer to as weed, when we tend to call the same plant not as weed anymore, but wild, and what is then the term naturally growing means. I've used the phrase naturally growing in my coloring book too. This would include the plant that could be wild or could be cultivars, but are growing on their own naturally. When usually cultivars grow naturally in the garden, the term is, in the gardening terms, it is called volunteering. Very different from the common usage of it, of course. I often call the weedy plants wild, weedy, uncultivated greens. So we kind of addressed what is wild in this context. What is weedy? So when a weed becomes, comes up in your yard and you recognize them, we usually term it as wild and let it grow if we know the usage of it. It is still uncultivated in a way. What if we collect the seeds and grow them? Surely we cannot be calling it uncultivated anymore. Can we? But can we still call it wild? This last question we did not cover in the last podcast, and I had requested you to hold the thought so that we can discuss it in this week. From time immemorial, human beings have adopted plants for their own use by selective breeding and by grafting. Why? To make the plant more tasty, of course, but more importantly, to make it easier to digest. You see, human beings are omnivores, correct? But our guts does not have the full capacity of digesting foods that herbivores like cows and goats have, and neither do we have the full ability to digest all that the carnivores eat. So, in fact, the success of human being as a species largely owes to its ability to cook. Some believe that it is fire that makes us human. I read an article by Jerry Adler, who wrote a science article that said fire and language are two factors that play a key role in survival of our species. It is, of course, important to imagine a human society that does not have, impossible to imagine a human society that does not have a language. Even animals have, means of communication in a way as a language. But given the right climate and adequacy of raw wild food, could there be a, ancient tribe that survives without cooking? In fact, no such people have ever been found, nor will they be, according to a provocative theory by Harvard biologist Richard Wrangham, who believes that fire is needed to fuel the organ that makes human brain function the way it does. According to Dr. Wrangham, in the wild, people typically survive only a few months without cooking, even if they could obtain meat. What does it say about raw food enthusiasts? I'm sure those who are making those choices have done their research. By the way, do not feel bad about the carnivores around us, though. They cannot digest all that we can digest also, like, our pets like cats and dogs. For example, they cannot digest theobromine, a chemical present in chocolate. We can. Okay, I'm digressing. Let's get back to where we were. Apart from cooking, humans also adopted plants over centuries, sometimes to make them not just tasty. I gave the example of mangoes in the last podcast. From the wild fibrous fruit, the fruit that once only for, you know, fruited only once in 5 years, and it has converted to our thin-skinned, thin-seeded, custardy-pulped mango that grows annually. And we feel sad when a tree skips producing good amount of fruit in a particular year, which they, you know, sometimes does. You know, every alternate year it actually produces a little less. And then we feel like, you know, bad about that. Imagine once in 5 years to annually. This did not happen in one day, though, or even in a few years. Have you heard about this plant called teosinte? I included a picture of this plant in the associated podcast. Have a look. It's a wild variety of plant. Do you know which one? I can give you a hint. This plant, currently the production worldwide is about a billion ton. A billion ton of this, you know, crop is produced. Any thoughts? Well, it actually has gone overboard because some of the applications of these plants are not always environment friendly. It actually allows the industrial animal farming in the West. But it is also now a source of renewable energy, biofuel. Now you must have got it. It is corn. So can you believe that? The wild variety of corn was a branching plant. The fruit was just, you know, 2 to 3 inches long and had all about, you know, 12 seeds or kernel compared to more than 500 kernel and a typical corn that we have today. Not just that, the teosinte kernels was encased in hard coating, allowing them to survive the digestive tracts of birds and grazing mammals for better dispersal in the wild. But for human, this tooth-cracking coating is completely undesirable and not easy to digest at all. Cellulose is a complex carbohydrate that we can't digest. So plants that are mostly cellulose are indigestible for humans. Some cellulose is good for us because it's a dietary fiber, but it costs us energy to have it go through our system. Not the same for herbivores though. They can manage. So this outer coating of teosinte was so undesirable that part was selected and reduced until they remain as a translucent casing of sort that remains in the cob when we eat corn in the cob. So how long did it take humans to go from teosinte to today's corn? A long time. Between 6,000 and 10,000 years ago, Native Americans living what is now called Mexico began domesticating teosinte. Its loose translation is grains of the gods. Scientists are not at all on the same page about how long it took to domesticate it, but around 4,500 years ago, a plant recognizable as today's corns was present across the Americas. A study revealed that a total of 59,000 genes in the corn genome, approximately of which 1,200 were preferentially targeted for selection during this domestication process by the Native Americans. Wow. Even as I say this, I get goosebumps of appreciation. These were people who were driven by their will to make their own lives and lives of their future generations better. Teosinte transformed too much from where it started what the botanists, so much it transformed that the botanists didn't even recognize. They knew the plant teosinte, but they couldn't actually even believe that this plant could be the ancestral plant for the corn. So for a long time, it remained unrecognized. Scientists now think that domestication of corn was successful because of a symbiotic relation between human and the plant that had developed and flourished over the millennia. Humans were part of the natural system themselves. By cultivating corn, human got a reliable source of food, and corn was regularly sown in nutrient-rich environment. So the plant didn't have to work so hard. So actually, when its hard coating went away and became a translucent thin coating, it didn't mind. So, oh my God, so you must be thinking, it takes that long to adopt a plant? Yes, it does. Imagine this was thousands of years before Gregor Mendel postulated his theories of genetics and heredity. Indigenous people across the tropical world were breeding desirable traits of grains, rice, and others. We do not often credit our ancestors enough. How many of us know about Mendel? Most of us read about his experiment with seven traits of peas and heredity in school. But did we hear about the groundbreaking domestication of rice or corn or other fruits and vegetables that we take granted today? What is sad is not that we do not know much about them. When we know, often it is a convoluted history that is offered to us that gives the credit elsewhere. For example, the conventional history of corn will tell you that it was domesticated in France. Of course, centuries after, it was already in use in the Americas. Imagine that this happened with all the grains and fruits that we happily cultivate today. Sometimes we do not recognize them either, like the scientists did not recognize the ancestors of corn. Okay, do I give you a trivia here? You may have known and eaten or heard about the fruit called durian, right? Guess what it is, its close cousin is. No, it's not jackfruit. A plant I have already mentioned in this podcast. Do you know? Can you guess? Well, it is cacao or cocoa, the fruit that from which the chocolate is made. It's actually closest cousin to durian. It looks completely different. So who knows, the wild variety may have, developed somewhere. And from that, again, people had adopted them for different traits, and one became a cocoa plant and the other became durian. Okay, let's get back to our podcast. I had mentioned tomatoes volunteering or growing naturally a lot of time. We do not call it wild because, just like the examples I have given here, it too is a product of centuries of selection. So we do not call them wild. When you grow Alternanthera ficoidea, for example, or slender joyweed, in a pot and prefer certain variety over the other, you may have initiated the process of selection, but the plant is still wild. I hope it clarifies why some plants are wild and the other, even though when they are naturally growing, we do not refer them as wild. That brings me to my pet topic. You must have heard this before if you have come to my weed box, and I think I have mentioned a few times in the podcast also. This sense of inquiry, this connection with nature, this diligence to remain connected, that cross generations is our tradition. Our traditions are not necessarily old recipes or vessels. Don't get me wrong. They are great. Yummy recipes and those ecological and hygienic cooking pots all are good. Just that the tradition we are losing and need to revive does not require us to lament about the recipe we have lost from our grannies, but the connection to nature here and now that our grandparents had, but we are choosing to ignore. With that, I'll end today. Stay well and stay safe. I'll see you next week.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.